Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, covering topics of interest to lawyers handling civil appellate matters in Texas courts. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the Texas appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Jody Sanders.
And I'm Todd Smith.
Like many of you, we're at home today, following the latest developments on the coronavirus front and trying to adjust to this new normal for a while.
To help our listeners on that front, we're welcoming back one of our original guests and the person who helped push us to put this podcast together, Blake Hawthorne, the Texas Supreme Court clerk. Welcome back, Blake.
Thanks. It's nice to be back, although via video conference this time instead of in our courtroom.
We're definitely practicing our social distancing on this podcast right now.
Absolutely. Well, we knew we wanted to have you back, Blake, but we didn't expect it to be so soon. In fact, I believe the way the timing of this is going to work out is you're actually going to be two episodes in a row, because we just released the initial interview that we did with you, and we're going, because of the nature of the subject matter we expect to talk about today, we're going to push this one up in priority and try to get it released within hopefully just a day or two after recording to make sure that folks get the information that we're going to be covering. These recent developments have kind of brought some things to the forefront, I would say, and it would be useful for Texas lawyers to hear from you on things like how the court is dealing with this COVID situation, the coronavirus situation, some of the emergency orders that have been released, and basically where we go from here, where we anticipate going. To kind of kick it off, it was, I don't know if listeners have had a chance to listen to the Justice Boyd interview from earlier this month, but when we were there in the Supreme Court courtroom, Justice Boyd talked about disaster preparedness and his role on in leading that charge, the organized charge on that. We sure didn't appreciate how quickly things would escalate. I mean, this was literally just a few weeks ago there in the courtroom, and the court has taken some what I would think would be unprecedented steps at this point. You want to kind of give us an overview?
I think when you all were here in the courtroom, it was just a week before my office practiced everyone working from home, because we foresaw that something like this could be coming down the road. And I think right after, right before Justice Boyd talked to you, we met in conference and we had talked as a group about what we needed to do to start preparing our own staff. So I had already planned to, as an experiment, because I'm the person here at the court that's responsible for our continuity of operations planning, our COOP plan, as it's known in the business. And so, of course, I wanted to talk to the court about what we were doing to get prepared in case something like this happened. Before the AISD, the Austin Independent School District, shut down, day before that, we had had everyone in the clerk's office work from home, myself included. And we worked through that day issues with our phone system and VPN and other things like that. So when we finally did send people home to work from home, I felt like we were pretty well prepared here in the clerk's office. And I don't think we've really missed a beat in terms of answering phone calls and processing filings. So I think from the outside world, it probably looks pretty much like business as usual, although obviously here at the court, things look very different. It's just me and one other staff person here in the clerk's office. We're in separate offices and we're keeping our distance from each other and yelling at each other out of the door sometimes. But we're still picking up the mail and processing that. But it's pretty quiet around here. The parking garage is pretty much empty. And I know it's the same situation at other appellate courts around the state. I know, for example, Michael Cruz, who's the clerk of the Fourth Court of Appeals in San Antonio, said that they had mandated there that everyone work from home about a week ago, and that it was just him and his chief deputy clerk there in the clerk's office. I think something similar just happened in Dallas County where they issued a shelter in place order. I know I was talking to the clerk of the county court there, John Warren, this morning about what's going on with his staff. And I think it's something similar to what we're doing here. They've got just a couple of people in the office that are running the office, dealing with anything that might need to be dealt with in the office, and then everyone else is working remotely. But, you know, electronic filing has really been the thing that's kind of saved our bacon here and all of this and kept the courts moving. I think if we didn't have that, we would really be struggling right now.
How have the justices changed the way that they operate through this time?
Well, they're working remotely, obviously, and their staff is too now. And for them, that may be the biggest change, is that normally I think they've got most of their staff is in the office on a daily basis. As you know, some of them don't live in Austin, and so they may be more accustomed to working from home. So it, in terms of how they work, it may not be that big of a change for them. Certainly for their staff, I think it's a big change. I know the law clerks were sending around instructions to each other about how to use their OneDrive, which I think most of them probably hadn't used much until this happened. So I know in some courts what we're seeing is things like OneDrive and probably, you know, Zoom teleconferencing like we're using right now are things that have been sort of accelerated. You know, going back to Michael Cruz, I talk about him because he used to be a deputy clerk here, and so I'm in contact with him quite a bit. But, you know, he talked about how he had a 5-year plan for getting some technology implemented there in the Fourth Court of Appeals, and that this has really just accelerated everything. That they're rolling out OneDrive and Microsoft Teams, and people are learning things that maybe they were a little bit resistant to before. Maybe they weren't excited about using, and now they're finding they really need to use it. It's a necessity for them.
So it sounds like there's going to be some adjustments, or have been some adjustments, to the basic workflow, but all the infrastructure was already there. I mean, what about the TAMS system? Are the judges able to access that and continue the normal process there?
They can, and they always have been able to through VPN. They complain a bit that it's a little bit slow sometimes. Using VPN and using our case management system, which is TAMS, which is a homegrown system, which is hosted on a server here in Austin. So they can VPN into it, and they can still do their voting remotely. I suspect a lot of them, probably the way they work really is off the website. And so they're getting a lot of the briefs just like you would by going to the website and looking at the cases there and reading what they need to read there. They're probably getting the purple sheet, which is the list of everything that's been sent up on a particular Tuesday. They may be getting that emailed to them, or they may be looking at that list in TAMS and then going to the website and looking at the briefs there. We do have the ability for them to go into the conference agenda and push a button and have everything exported to a drive for them that's organized in a folder structure. I don't know how many of them are using that, but they certainly have the ability to do that if they like and work that way so that everything is actually physically downloaded to their computer. No doubt they are finding new and maybe more efficient ways to get access to documents that they need in order to do their work.
And since the courts kind of jumped on this in the last couple of weeks, there's been a series of emergency orders that have come out dealing with the administration of justice throughout the state. Can you kind of walk us through what those are and tell us some of the issues that have come up that probably were unforeseen until they happened?
Sure. There have been a total of 6 emergency orders relating to the COVID-19 state of disaster issued since Governor Abbott declared a state of disaster in the state. The first emergency order required all judges in the state to avoid risk to court staff, parties, attorneys, jurors, and the public, and allow them to modify or suspend any and all deadlines and procedures prescribed by a statute, rule, or order for a stated period ending no later than 30 days after the governor's state of disaster has been lifted. So essentially, this order then goes on to talk about doing things remotely in order to avoid people coming into contact with each other. So in other words, holding hearings via teleconference, the Office of Court Administration's entered into a statewide contract for Zoom, which maybe we'll talk a little more about later. But it also allows depositions to be conducted remotely. It allows witnesses to testify remotely. So that's kind of at the heart of what the first order was about. So the second order clarified that for all those child custody agreements out there, that they should go by the established school schedule, because as you know, a lot of the schools were closing, or redoing their schedules, extending their spring breaks. Mm-hmm. And so there were a lot of issues arising as to, well, if a spring break was extended, did that mean that custody was extended? So the court heard a lot from family law judges about that. So they issued that order.
I saw a lot of family law practitioners talking about that on Twitter and Facebook. And I think it's great that the court clarified that so we would avoid a lot of headache. You know, that had to be a difficult situation, but you can only imagine what that would have done to our existing court system if suddenly we had hundreds or thousands of custody modification issues, compliance with the regular orders. So that was one of the things that I didn't anticipate myself looking at this. And I saw that order come out, and having seen that and heard that discussion among the family lawyers, I thought that was a great solution for the court to just go on record as saying, this is how it's going to go.
Yeah, I'm still, it was pretty well publicized, but I'm still hearing from some people calling that are representing themselves that are still having issues with parents about that and wondering, how do I go about getting the other side to recognize this order? So, but it's been well publicized, so I think the public in general is pretty well aware of it. The third order sort of modified the first order, and it prohibited judges from conducting non-essential proceedings in person, contrary to local, state, or national directives. We've had a few shelter-in-place orders issued here lately, so I think you see the obvious relevance of that now. And the Governor Abbott had an executive order that limited group sizes to 10 or less, and so the order stated that courts should not schedule any in-person proceedings that would cause more than 10 people to gather in the courtroom, which I guess is just so happens to be 9 Supreme Court judges and 1 assistant. So I don't know if that had any relevance to it, but I was just noticing that today, that I guess it wouldn't prohibit all of them from getting together.
Court could meet in conference if it needed to, but shouldn't need to with the technology now.
Right. So that was the third order, pretty much just modified the first. And then the fourth order prohibits a trial, hearing, or other proceeding and an eviction to recover possession of residential property. So the court obviously saw that there were a lot of businesses closing down and foresaw that there could be a lot of people that were hopefully just temporarily out of work and weren't able to pay their rent. And obviously that would be a very unfortunate situation if people were forced out in the streets right now. So essentially eviction proceedings are on hold for a period of time. We have been getting a few calls about that from constables and tenants and the like, but not too terribly many questions, so hopefully that's running smoothly. And then the fifth and sixth order really relate to state bar matters. The fifth order put attorney disciplinary proceedings on hold and told the time periods in those proceedings. And then the sixth order just says the state bar election, which is coming up, shall be conducted entirely electronically. That was due, I mean, as you can imagine, the state bar, just like everybody else, is running on a skeleton crew and having to count a bunch of paper ballots would just be, I think, too difficult at this point.
So. I also read Randy Sorrells put out a statement that indicated that the mailing house that the state bar was using was out of New York, and there was an issue with the stability of being able to handle getting mailings out, plus New York being one of the sort of quasi epicenters of, or at least having one of the higher incidences of the coronavirus currently. I wonder, I was thinking about this yesterday, having seen that order, I wonder if we'll ever go back to mailing. Now, once we've switched to electronic, I mean, we've seen a lot of innovation that's been forced to come out of this situation. And it would seem to me that once we handle this electronically, would it make any sense at all to go back to paper ballots? And course, Blake, you know what my opinion about that would be. I think it's the same as yours. No.
Yeah. So I think that most ballots were being cast electronically anyway, but of course, paper was still out there. And as I learned, you know, when we were doing electronic filing, a lot of people felt like, well, you know, if electronic filing is so great, everyone will just do it voluntarily. But of course, after struggling with that for a decade, we figured out that wasn't the case. And sometimes you just have to, you know, get people to move on to the new technology that's out there. And we talked a little bit about how this is sort of forcing, I think, many of us really to start getting familiar with some of the technology that's available to us. And I don't doubt that this is going to change the way many of us do business for years going forwards. I suspect that we're going to see a lot more people working remotely, probably more opportunities for people to work remotely, people using like the technology we're using right now, the video conferencing and the like, and the file sharing. Like we weren't really using our OneDrives, I think, very much here at the court, even though we really encourage people to do it, because we had instances in which we lost our server for a couple of days. And, you know, when that happens, you lose your work. And so we were trying to get people to go to OneDrive, which we felt like was in the cloud and was more reliable, maybe than some of the aging hardware that we had here at the court. Frankly, just couldn't get everybody to do it. I think this is really going to push them all to do it and start working that way.
Right.
And we talked a little bit about Zoom accounts, and you mentioned in the order that OCA had gotten a statewide one. Have you heard good, bad, indifferent, any feedback on courts using Zoom accounts for proceedings?
Yeah, so I've talked to a lot of my colleagues around the country about whether they're doing oral arguments via video conferencing, and I actually heard from a few high courts that had held oral arguments via video conference or were planning to. I didn't really hear any negative feedback from them. I heard some good ideas. One was that one of the clerks, I think it was the clerk of the North Dakota Supreme Court, so that everybody would know how much time was remaining, her camera on her laptop showed the courtroom timer, which I thought was a clever solution for
that is
handling the timing situation. I did hear, though, on Twitter, I think it was Bob Loeb that was tweeting about watching the D.C. Circuit Court that was live streaming on YouTube a video oral argument and talking about how one of the judges dropped out of the feed, that he thought that there was some instances in which people couldn't hear each other very well. And I can certainly see where this is something you're going to want to, if you're going to have an oral argument via video conference, you want to try it out first.
Sure.
Not something you just want to dive into. Yeah. You know, you want to make sure that everybody's tested out their microphones and everybody has a good Wi-Fi connection. You know, maybe they don't want to be doing it on the cellular connection on their phone. So just some things to think about, I think, in terms of what you need to plan for before you just jump into it. I know that Judge Emily Miskell, who's a judge up in Denton County, has been using Zoom to hold family hearings and family cases. And I think that she's learned a lot, really, about how best to conduct those proceedings via video conference, even just some simple things like, you know, having a slide that just sort of tells people that they're in the queue, you know, waiting to go live with the judge, and some things about telling people, you know, once it begins, just kind of reminding them that it is being video recorded, that if it's streaming through their YouTube channel, just some things like that. Like we go through in the courtroom with all of our arguments, you know, we remind everyone that the arguments are being webcast live and that they'll be available later. We have an order on our website about webcasting now that says that if you have an objection to it, that you can object to it. We've never had anyone object to it. But I think just some of those things that you probably want to think about before you start with video conferencing proceedings, just in terms of making sure that technology is working for you, that you're familiar with how it all works, and also, too, that you make sure that the parties and the public are aware that that's what you're doing.
So I suppose OCA and David Slayton's folks are super busy trying to get this Zoom integration or the Zoom rollout to the judges. I mean, have they been receptive?
Well, I know, you know, of course, the people you start with are the evangelists for these things, of course.
Right.
And I think David definitely has a couple of folks, Emily Miskell in particular, Judge Miskell has, I think, been really great about working with the Office of Court Administration on Zoom hearings and testing all that out, and then passing on the other judges the things that she's learning about how to conduct courtroom proceedings using video conferencing. So I think it probably will take hold. I think it takes time. You know, it's new to a lot of people, and a lot of them aren't going to probably want to jump into it really until they really need to. But I think more, you know, the longer this goes on, I think the more we're going to see a need for it, and probably the more judges we'll see that are using video conferencing technology.
There's that, and also it seems like the clerk's offices would want to do what they could to help facilitate moving the dockets along. You know, we're really at a standstill, and you know, have been for a bit, and we can only imagine what the ramifications of this are going to be long term. But in the short term, you know, it seems like we would need to keep cases moving, and not only would the Zoom video hearings be a good option for doing that, but there's plenty of motions that can be heard on submission. The example of summary judgments comes to mind. And so I would encourage the clerk's offices and the court administrative staff locally to consider, I mean, Travis County is set up to where it should be able to handle this and getting issues presented to the courts for decision. You know, rather than have things just completely come to a halt, it would seem like a good use of the court's time and the staff's time once we kind of figure out, you know, what this new normal is going to look like, at least in the short term, to try to get issues teed up to the courts, even if it doesn't require a Zoom hearing. Hopefully the parties can get together and agree to submit certain things on the papers only, so that, you know, to take a little bit of a load off of the system.
Yeah, I suppose it's tough. On the one hand, you know, you've got all these orders saying that you should extend deadlines and, you know, accommodate requests for extensions and the like. And then you've got to decide, I guess, you know, what's really important right now. But I know that there are a lot of people that would probably like to get back to work. And there are probably a lot of people Absolutely. That would like to, you know, move on with cases. And maybe, like you say, if both sides are agreeable to it and you can get some judges to start using the video conferencing technology that's available to them to hold some hearings, maybe they could get up and running and start moving some of these things along that people are agreeable to moving through the courts.
And in the long term, it may be, once all this is kind of over and we're back to whatever normal is, it may be an access to justice thing that helps out, gets people in front of courts in ways that they may not have been able to before because of cost, you know, travel times, those types of things.
That's a great point. And, you know, the Zoom technology, which every judge in the state now has access to, and which they can stream on a YouTube channel so that the public has access to it as well if they want to, is available on your phone. So anyone could use it. People, you know, representing themselves could use it as well. And it might really be a great way for the courts to make access to justice more convenient and faster and more efficient.
Well, I have one last question for you, Blake. Should we be on the lookout? I noticed that when you put out the last emergency order, I think you tweeted it out on Sunday night at like 9 p.m., which, you know, good for you and keeping the public aware, and good for the court for getting these things out there as soon as possible without regard for ordinary business hours. Are there any further emergency orders that we should expect to see or anticipate coming in the coming days?
Well, you know, it's funny you should ask that because, yes, Chief Justice Nathan Hecht never sleeps, apparently. So Sunday evening, he emailed and asked for an administrative order number. And then the next thing you know, we were issuing an emergency order. But, you know, one of the consequences, I think, of everybody working remotely is that, honestly, I'm less aware now when those orders are about to come down. And I think some of those conversations that used to happen when we were all in the same room together, and so, of course, I would know about it all, some of those conversations are happening now via email between the judges, and I may not necessarily be aware of it before it comes. The order, for example, on the evictions, I actually learned about that from Chuck Lindell with the Austin American Statesman, who said, "Hey, I hear you're about to issue this order." And I said, "We are." And turns out we were about to issue that order. So Funny. So obviously Chuck doing a great job there. I don't know who his sources
scooping the clerk.
Are, but he's got better sources than I do. So yeah. But anyway, so I'm sure that hopefully we're going to start communicating with each other a little better. But yeah, some of them have surprised me just as much as they've surprised you all. I don't know if another one is coming down, but I am now checking my email all hours of the day now. And so you may see tweets from me at all hours of the day now with stuff coming out.
Well, and on that subject, I've noticed the last couple of days you've been at all hours kind of tweeting out some tips for people that can help them streamline the process and keep things moving even while courts are kind of on pause. Do you have a tip or anything or a couple of them you'd like to share here just in closing?
Yeah, I tweeted out this tip. A lot of people were contacting the office about having trouble submitting motions, you know, that may require an affidavit or may require a notary. So, you know, prologue vice motions, things like that, where they might need a notary. And people might want to take a look at online notaries who are authorized to notarize via two-way video and audio conferencing under government code 406.107 through 113 and civil practice and remedies code 121.006. Also, you should take a look at civil practice and remedies code 132.001, which offers basically a way for a witness to swear to a document without the need for a notary. So check those out. I think you might find that useful since may not be able to get to a notary in person, may not be able to have them come to an office and notarize something. So I think that's, again, taking advantage of the tools that are out there and available to us, folks might want to look into that.
That's great. Well, I think that's a good point to wrap up with. Blake, thanks for coming back on the show. I'll just say basically the same thing I said last time. We expect you'll probably be back again at some point. It would be nice to put a little space in between your next appearance. Hopefully we're managing the coronavirus situation and we're in more in the business of returning things to normal than responding to this pandemic. But we really appreciate you coming back.
Well, I appreciate you guys and thanks for helping us spread the word about how we can adapt to these times and hopefully everybody get back to work and keep the court system running.
That's great. Thanks for listening to this episode. If you're enjoying the podcast, we'd be grateful if you'd help us get the word out by recommending it to colleagues you think might benefit from listening. Taking the time to rate it on Apple Podcasts would really help us too.
And if you have questions, thoughts, or comments, please shoot us an email or message us on Twitter or just reach out through the podcast Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you.
Until next time, we wish you all the best and hope you're all staying safe and healthy.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. To stay in touch with your hosts, suggest topics, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or on Twitter at texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.